Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today on Writers' Voices is Joanne Howard, who is an Asian American writer from California. She holds an MFA in writing from Pacific University. Her poetry received an honorable mention from Stanford University's 2019 Paul Kalanithi Writing Award, and her fiction has been widely published, as well as her nonfiction. She lives in Santa Rosa, California, and the book that we're talking about today is Sleeping in the Sun. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Joanne.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat with you about my debut novel.
So tell me a little bit about why you wanted to write this particular novel.
Oh, well, you know, the story is very personal to me as it is inspired by my grandfather's childhood in growing up in colonial India. They were an American missionary family, and I just thought that this dynamic of Americans in India was very unique. It's something I had never seen before in books that I've come across, and I think they occupied a very interesting third role in this historic time period, which is, you know, predominantly pretty it's just dominated by typically the British viewpoint. And so I thought that their experience as Americans could bring a refreshing perspective of that time period.
So I have to ask, is Gene your grandfather?
actually, no. My grandfather is actually Will, the second oldest brother. So there are four brothers.
Okay.
But Gene is the main character. He's the youngest. And I just thought that the youngest brother kind of has a unique perspective as well, just because, you know, he's more of the underdog. And as you'll see in the book, he kind of views the world differently from his older brothers, who have kind of already made their own opinions and prejudices, whereas Gene is a little bit more naive and somewhat more innocent. And so I thought that his viewpoint could be just more dynamic and complex.
So I don't want to do any spoilers, but in real life, did your grandfather's family leave India before the British got kicked out?
Oh, actually, yes. So they did. They left actually they left in 1946. So they did take a long time to leave. They were there for 34 years, which is a very long time.
Whoa.
And I think that, yeah, they were very committed to their cause as American Baptist missionaries. And I also thought that was a somewhat refreshing perspective too, where just to view a foreigner Western presence in India as earnest and genuine, because I think 34 years is, you know, is a huge commitment. And they really, just from the family documents that I was able to dig up and research through, it really did seem like they took their presence there very seriously and genuinely. So, and they spent a long time there.
Wow. So how old was your grandfather when he came back to America, or actually didn't come back? Was he born in India then?
Yeah, so he was born in India. Yes. So he had never set foot in the U.S. until about college age. They all left to go to college in the U.S. Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, India was all my grandfather had ever known. And Bengali was his first spoken language before English even was. And so moving to the U.S. like was a pretty big change for them. One detail that stuck out to me in one of their diaries was that they would have to learn the English words for the spices in the grocery stores in the U.S. So I thought that was a funny detail.
So this book is not biographical about your grandfather's family.
No. It's certainly the jumping off point is my family there. And there are scenes and details like the descriptions of the house or, you know, of course, the real places that exist, like the Howrah train station. Those are based in reality, but yeah, the storyline and the big plot points, yeah, those were developed by my own imagination.
And did you do a lot of research on this time period outside of the, family documents that you had?
Yes, of course. Yeah, that was kind of one of the things that I needed to even actually pull back on because, of course, it's a vast history of the British in India, and you can go back centuries and look at, every region of India and the effects of it. But I did mostly start with researching through my own family documents. I have like my grandfather's childhood diaries, for example, and then a lot of the family members wrote their own memoirs of the time. So it was quite
Really?
of yeah, it's incredible, and we preserved it all, and it was really, just an incredible starting point for their everyday lives. So, and I did do a lot of historical research about about the general time period of the country as a whole, but I also was very mindful to keep the scope small with the story and to just have it be a story about the family and not really be, a big retelling of any historical event in India. I treated it more as a story and not, like a history textbook. But of course, yeah, lots of research needs to be done to make sure that, the right context is being described and worked through with the
Right.
story.
But there were things in in your story that were going on in the wider world, some protests and so forth.
Right.
Were they based on actual individual protests or just general what was going on?
It was a bit more general. I think that I did want to touch on the fact that Calcutta and Bengal in general were they tended to be more progressive than other places in India. The British capital used to be in Calcutta, but because there was such a pushback from the people in Bengal, they actually moved the capital to New Delhi, which is where it is now today. But so I did want to bring that kind of atmosphere of protest and progressive thinking and anti-Raj thinking as well, because that absolutely affects the plot of the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned, the youngest son, Gene, is one of the main characters in the story, but you have another point of view character as well.
Yeah, so Arthur is the family's only Indian servant, and that is actually somewhat unusual because a family that large, Western family that large, would have had typically a whole staff, especially with such a huge house that they're in. But he is kind of alone, and there is a sense of loneliness and solitude that he has. And so that's sort of something that he grapples with, but also uses to kind of relate to Jean, who also feels like somewhat alone in the world or in his family. And so I thought that those two characters had enough similarities to kind of tell the story together, but of course they're because of their identities, they have very different experiences of their world. So yeah, Arthur kind of goes on a journey of like self-discovery. He is encouraged by other characters to rethink his relationship to this family that he has served his whole adult life. And he kind of comes to a conclusion in the end that, sets everything in motion.
There's a lot of pushback these days about kind of writing from the perspective of the other. So, you're American and you're writing from the pers partially from the perspective of a colonial servant. What steps did you take to be sure that you were being sensitive in that.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I was very aware of that sensitivity in the book world. And yeah, so I'm not Indian. But this is my family's story, and I felt the right to tell it. And I do actually believe that artists who are genuine, I think, can write whatever they want to. And I don't think that art should require permission, but it does require respect. And one of the tools, of course, is research and to be mindful that, you're not perpetuating any harmful stereotypes or, writing this other character as, flat or not giving them as much, dynamics or complexity as your other characters who do align with your identity. But then the other thing too is that I used a sensitivity reader, which is a great tool to have for writers who are writing outside of their identity. Why not? And I think it's
And
just a no-brainer.
how did you find this, your sensitivity reader?
Well, so my publisher did recommend a couple of people of resources. I actually you can just Google that as well. It's a whole industry that I think is really rising, and you can find people who are pretty aligned with whatever character identity you are trying to work with. So it's quite easy. It's not, a niche thing anymore. So I really
Well,
recommend it
that's
all.
really interesting. Yeah. Now, you did they come back with things that you changed?
No, because I am very, I'm very, I feel pretty confident, and I did write with, genuine intentions and what I hope is, good-heartedness. There were a couple of things that my sensitivity reader picked out that were unusual, and one of them was that this family only has one servant, which is a bit odd. And a family of this size would at least have a Dalit who would, empty the latrines or something like that. Another thing that was odd is that Arthur is an only child, given his background, as you'll see in his backstory later in the book. That would also be odd as well, that he has such a small family. But I figured, I'm okay with that. These like somewhat, they're not like inaccurate, but they are, just unusual and uncommon. And I thought it was okay. I think there can be room for that in fiction.
Right. And I mean, they were an American missionary family living on not a lot of money.
Exactly. Yes, that's true. Yeah. So I actually think there's a good reason for that.
Right. And there's a lot of reasons that people don't have big families.
Sure.
Why Arthur would be an only child, it might be unusual, but certainly not unique.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So now, you did, as a, in your press kit, it says something about how your background as an Asian American writer influenced your portrayal of cross-culture interactions. So, how did you draw from your own experience?
Yeah, so I am half Asian, I'm half Chinese, and just hearing my mom, who was born in Hong Kong, and grew up in the US, and a lot of mixed people will probably relate to this idea of belonging and struggling with belonging. And while it's for very different reasons, I think Gene and his family kind of struggle with belonging in India and figuring out like their place in this society. And then Arthur is also, he has that kind of perspective of between figuring out his true self and his pure self, not influenced by the way people think of him, and then the way that others do think of him, that kind of external influence over his own identity. So I thought that was, something that I could see in myself and use that to kind of bring my own perspective to this book, because I totally could identify with that, the way that, you know, people view mixed people could also be, oh, you aren't enough of one thing. You aren't enough American, or you aren't enough whatever country your nationality is. And I think that there are levels of that that you can see in the book, especially with Gene, who and his brothers, who, you know, they're American, but they're born in India and have never actually been to the U.S. And but they're also not British, which is the predominant Western community in India at this time period. So they kind of don't really belong either. So, yeah, I was able to kind of bring my own perspective to that.
Yeah, Gene, I like Gene.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Some of the other brothers, not so much, but but Gene was a good kid. And Arthur, too. I mean, you definitely let us know both of these people. Now, why did you choose to not write from a female perspective?
Because
you do have female characters that you could have used as a point of view character.
I guess I never really made a conscious decision. I think it was probably just driven by the real life fact that these were four brothers, my grandpa and his three other brothers. So it was probably as simple as that. But I do want to point out that I do have secondary female characters who, while they may not be main characters, we don't really get into their psyche, but they do affect the plot very much so, or they do
reflect
reflect things that might not be as obvious if they weren't in the story. And for example, I think that like having the two contrasting characters are Mrs. Hinton, who is the mother of the family, and Jaya, who is an Indian woman who comes to visit the boarding house. And I think one of the big differences there is that Jaya seems, as you'll kind of discover throughout the book, she has a lot more freedom to move around. Like, she literally showed up at this house by herself, whereas Mrs. Hinton is kind of stuck in a more like societal role. And she, you know, takes very seriously her appearance, and, you know, raising these kids, and she is more restricted, which I thought was kind of ironic in some sense, because, you know, typically a white woman would have a lot more power than an Indian woman in this time period. So I do think that they bring kind of a complexity to, you know, the way that, to the character dynamics, the way that the characters all affect each other.
And then there was a third character, female character, too, who was very interesting as well.
Oh, are you talking about Moti?
Well, no, I'm talking about Nir's sister.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Of course. And she's another level of that, you know, women being restricted or not. And
Right.
I'll actually leave that one maybe for the readers to discover, because she is a bit more mysterious, I would say.
Yes, yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Joanne Howard, author of Sleeping in the Sun, which is a novel set in India at the end of the British colonial period. It's interesting. You do have in the background kind of the political things that are going on, and Gandhi, and people who don't think Gandhi's going far enough, it definitely is not a, what would you say, it doesn't look at British colonialism through rose-colored glasses.
Right.
Definitely, it's like, what were these people doing here? Why were they doing this?
Mm. Yeah, I think that one of the big themes of the book is the end of things. The obvious one is that this end of the Raj is kind of impending, even though it's still, you know, a decade or so off from when this book takes place. There are, you know, whispers of the ending coming. And the family is talking about leaving India because it's, you know, no longer safe. And so I wanted to kind of have that sort of sense of doom, I suppose, that kind of permeate everything. And I liked that the landscape kind of reflected that. And I try not to, you know, be too, like, in general, I really try not to be too, like, heavy-handed with the history aspect of the book. But I thought that I could use the landscape, and there's this scene of, like, the tree roots kind of reclaiming the tennis courts that are on the properties, landscape. And so I kind of liked the idea of the natural world kind of encroaching onto these houses, which have been there for a long time. The house that the family lives in was a former British officer's house. It's this big white concrete cold kind of building. But the imagery of the nature kind of taking, reclaiming the land, I thought could kind of be symbolic of this ending that's coming.
Now, did your grandfather ever go back to India?
He actually didn't. And I think part of it is that, you know, he knew that it was going to change so much. And he just kind of wanted to preserve his childhood memory of India, I think, and not change it so much. But he had very fond memories of that time, and he continued to speak Bengali to his brothers over the phone, or to
really,
they did, yeah, and to cook these big feasts of Indian food, and he really loved the culture and his childhood from there, yeah. Even though he didn't go back to India,
did he remain, like, he grew up as a Christian missionary? Did he remain active in that sense, in that, or did he?
So
not?
All the brothers, yeah. So the four brothers, like, interestingly, had different reactions to their upbringing. So the grandfather, who's the padre in the book, was extremely devout. The only book he seemed to read was the Bible, and it actually, for my grandpa's case, it actually, I do think, turned him off of Christianity as a whole. And he, I think he, yeah, he did. He completely broke with the religion. And as far as I know, was not particularly religious or spiritual, because I think, you know, he just didn't like it as a kid. I think,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Strict and overbearing. Whereas other brothers, they went back to India and helped with the mission and, you know, stayed with it earnestly. And, you know, they connected with it that way. So I find that so fascinating. You know, children can have the exact same childhood environment, but come away.
Oh, yeah.
Different.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was raised in a fairly religious environment, and of five kids, we all went completely different directions.
Mm. Wow.
In terms of religion and spirituality.
Oh.
And so, yeah, it's
can
interesting.
I ask you, so what did you think of the religious or spiritual aspect of the book? I mean, did you, you know, have any thoughts on it?
Oh, yeah. I actually wanted to ask you a little bit more about this, because so they come to this one village and are able to convert the village to Christianity, but no one else other than this one village.
Right. Yes.
And they don't really do all that much in terms of, other than preaching every Sunday.
Right.
And
yeah.
Was that a realistic view of what these, you know, what would happen in these missions? In a way, it was almost having the guest house to take in people who were down and out was the true mission.
Right. Yeah, I think that this, so that was based in reality. They did run this boarding house, and they did preach at these, at the villages that they would visit. But they did also have a church. which I visited with my dad in Manipur. But I was very intentional in that I didn't want to have any scenes at the church. I wanted the family to go to the people in the village. And I think that this is reflective of the more effective method, I think, of changing people's lives rather than their thinking, because they didn't come into these villages and, hand out Bibles and tell everyone that they needed to forget everything that they know and start worshiping this other God. They instead, there's the scene in the book, which is based in reality, that tells the father coming into the village and just playing his flute and creating this moment of joy and inspiring curiosity in the people to just check out, who is this kind of strange man playing this flute in the village. And I thought that, and along with running this boarding house, which was a very effective way to change people's lives and help people in a way that was, realistic, I thought that was a refreshing perspective, I think, of missionaries or Westerners in India. Because, I think there's a lot of literature in the canon about British India of missionaries or, colonists just kind of being, extremely heavy-handed and aggressive with their influence. And so I thought this could be, a more refreshing perspective. And I liked that it, and of course it was based in reality that, my grandfather did actually, just this method of changing their lives rather than.
Yeah, and the father, he did seem, well, he seemed very sincere about wanting to help in a way and not just force his just not just force his beliefs on people. It's an interesting thing because I know quite a bit about kind of Indian spirituality and in general, Indian people believe their spirituality is superior to Western spirituality. So I'm not sure how open very many of them are to being preached
Yeah,
to.
that's exactly right. And I think, and there's a bit about that in the book where it's kind of not, I think I leave it a bit open-ended and, how much do these people like really sincerely believe or have, switched over to Christianity. And there's a scene at the end of the book where the boys kind of wonder, about that. Because I think they pick up on that too, that,
That they'll probably all convert back when when they
Exactly.
leave. That they were just sort of doing it to be nice to them.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Joanne, at what, how did you decide, okay, I'm going to write this story, and what did your writing process look like? You grew up with this story, and so was it always in the back of your mind someday that to create a novel based on this?
No, actually, I knew that my grandpa grew up in India, but I didn't really think of writing a story about it until one Thanksgiving that happened when I was in college in my undergrad, where we just kind of pulled out all of our family documents and those diaries and photographs, and I realized, just these vivid descriptions of India would just sounded so cinematic to me, and they would make an interesting story. So I knew that I always wanted to write a novel or multiple novels, hopefully in my life. I just like never really found the right idea to take me all the way through the years-long writing process of writing a novel until that Thanksgiving. And so then I looked into joining an MFA program, and at Pacific University in Oregon is where I wrote the first draft and went through several rounds of editing with the faculty there. So I really feel like I got a pretty solid start going through that curriculum. And
Now, was that
I
an online or in residence
no,
program?
it was in residence, yeah. So it's a
Okay.
two-year program. Twice a year we would have a residency in person with everyone and have a, just like a really intense 2-week period of classes and sessions together. But then, yeah, we would all go off on our own and write our theses. Some people wrote short stories or memoirs or poetry collections, and not many people wrote novels. I was never really that interested in writing a short story collection, or certainly not a memoir at my somewhat young age. So I wrote the novel in the program. Yeah, that's how it started.
And you mentioned that you have been to India yourself.
I went in 2018 with my family, and yeah, we visited a lot of the places that appear in the book, and then one of them that actually doesn't is their boarding school, but I think it's referenced in the book. And their boarding school, Woodstock School, is Woodstock International School, is still running, and it's a very lovely school in the foothills of the Himalayas. And it actually, there are photos of my grandpa and his brothers on the walls there in some of the hallways. So that was so neat to discover.
Wow, that is
Yeah.
cool. So, Joanne, why don't you read a little bit from Sleeping in the
Yeah, I'd
Sun?
love to. Chapter one. Last morning stars lingered over the big house when Jean Hinton saw the mourners coming up the road. Under the dormant frangipani trees, still yet to bloom, the procession approached slowly, quietly. As it came closer, Jean rubbed the sleep out of his eyes and folded his arms, hugging himself against the morning breeze in the front yard. He knew the afternoon would be hot and maybe less humid than yesterday, the Lord willing, but for now, nothing could warm him. He dug his shoes into the dirt and watched the road. The sight of the man in the front, dressed in white robes and with a shaved head, pulled at Jean's heart. "The eldest son," came a voice from behind. Jean turned to see Arthur, the Hinton servant, standing on the porch steps. He held his arms behind his back, allowing the front of his crisp iron kurta to billow in the breeze. "Kindly, Sahib," Arthur said, asking permission to approach. When Jean nodded, Arthur stepped forward and continued. "For Hindus, the eldest son leads the mourning of the father." A pause, and then, "But you won't ever have to worry about that, Sahib." As if on cue, chattering voices and loud footsteps arose from somewhere inside the house. Jean's older brothers were awake. Cold dread filled him down to his shoes. In a few minutes, they'd have to leave to meet Uncle Ellis at the train station. But Jean couldn't stop watching the lane. He didn't want to think about his father's inevitable death or of anyone's. 12-year-old boys didn't have to think of that sort of thing. So he changed the subject. "Did you know the man?" Jean said, "the one who died?" Procession passed the gate now. A swath of saffron was draped over the litter, carried by what looked like a dozen men, all either shouldering its burden or placing a hand on the litter, wherever there was space among the garlands and marigolds that dangled from the edges and danced with every step. Arthur wobbled his head. "I would see him in the marketplace when I did the shopping for Mem Sahib." But Jean could tell from his unsteady lip that the man had meant more to Arthur than that. "Should you maybe go with them wherever they're going?" "The Kangsabati River to be cremated," Arthur said. He bit his lip and looked at the road for a moment. "No, I am needed by the Padre Sahib. We are leaving soon for the Bora Sahib, not." The sound of the car engine firing up startled Jean. Wild monkeys scampered to life in the branches above him, screeching into the dawn. Jean turned to his father, ready at the wheel of the old Chevy. It would take the jalopy a few minutes to warm up. Jean looked back at the lane, but the men had passed them now, leaving only a mottled trail of dust that floated behind them as if they walked on a cloud. "To tell you the truth," Jean said, leaning in, "I'm nervous about meeting the judge, or Uncle Ellis, I suppose I should call him." Arthur tilted his head and looked at him the way one would study a bug. "I mean, I know my brothers all like him. I don't remember the last time I met him. I must have been too young, but from what everyone tells me about him, I feel like I should be, I don't know." He trailed off as he scuffed his dusty shoe in the dirt and frowned at his wrinkled trousers. better groomed at least. Fien realized the absurdity of his words, reminding himself of the dead man that just passed by not a minute ago. He met Arthur's eyes and nearly jumped at the dark look on his face. Arthur bent close, his eyes serious. "There are larger things to worry about with the Burra Sahib," he said. Jean didn't know what to say. He was about to ask Arthur what he meant when they were interrupted. "Come on, Jean, smallest in the middle." He looked to see John, Will, and Lee pouring through the front doors, a collective storm of barely contained teenage energy that felt absurd in the quiet morning. He whooped and hollered for no reason that Jean could tell until he remembered they had been looking forward to this day all week. Arthur retreated to the car to check that all was set to go, slipping away into the background of the family's lives again. "Scooch," Will said, shoving Jean into the car. "I'm going," Jean said, bumping his head on the roof as Will's shoulder blade jabbed into his chest. "Come on, make room," John said, squishing a leg into Jean's lap. Then more pressure, this time on his other side as Lee squeezed in. "Sorry," Lee said. Lee was only 2 years older than Jean, but he felt enormous. Jean couldn't move while his brothers arranged themselves for the long ride, their limbs sticking out of the open sides of the car. "That's better," John said. "Oof," Jean grumbled. Mrs. Hinton got in on the passenger side. Her cheeks were flushed, her clothes smelling of rosewater. "Oh, I look awful," she said, squinting into her compact mirror. She brushed the faded blonde hairs out of her face. "You'll think I haven't been taking care of myself." "You look fine," said Mr. Hinton. He straightened his topi, a large pith helmet to keep out the sun, and switched the headlights on, illuminating the sparse lawn and vine-choked trees in the yard. "It's just times like this I wish we could afford another servant, one who could do my hair. Boys, make room for Arthur to stand." Arthur stepped onto the running board and held onto the side of the roof. Even though there was just enough room in the front for one more person, it was reserved for Judge Ellis on the way back, and it didn't occur to anyone that it might be safer and more comfortable for Arthur to sit there for at least half the ride. "Ready, Sahib," Arthur said. Jean thought he might suffocate before the sun rose. He turned out of the drive and down the lane and past the procession along the side of the road. As Mr. Hinton slowed the car, the men kept their heads down and continued walking on their steady and gentle march to the river.
So that was Joanne Howard reading from Sleeping in the Sun. So when you went to Pacific University to work on this book, you went there specifically with the intention of working on this book. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yes.
And were you writing full time at that point?
Yes, I was working and writing full time. So professionally, I'm a copywriter, and I managed to just write this book over a period of 6 years, just through either waking up extremely early to get a few hours in before work, or on my lunch break at work, or after work. And you know, it took a lot longer than I would have liked, of course, but you know, that's the way it can get done, I think.
Absolutely. And yeah. So you like writing in the early morning?
Do. I find it's not so much that, you know, the writing is easier or, you know, I'm more motivated. I just find that if I don't do it first thing in the morning, there's a higher chance that I won't do it at all during the day. So better to just get it done. And I'm personally a morning person. So there were times when I would wake up at 4 a.m. and write, and maybe my brain was not fully functional.
Wow.
I thought it was better to get something on the page and to get something to work with, rather than wait around for when you are most motivated or inspired, because that might not come.
Right. And when you started writing this, did you know what the story, what the plot was going to be? You knew the characters because they were based on your family.
Yeah, I knew the characters, and I knew that the judge would kind of come in and be this catalyst for the action, but I didn't quite know where it was going to end up. Mm. But one of the aspects that I didn't add until the last couple rounds of editing was Moti the dog, who is on the cover.
Oh, and really?
So she was inspired by my own dog, Cash, who I got in 2020, and I had never had a dog before, but I just was so smitten with him, and he is so like a part of my heart that I just had to add a dog to my novel somehow. And she actually, you know, she's not just there for decoration. She actually, I think, is very, you know, central to at least Arthur's character arc and, you know, the way that he views the world. And she kind of is a presence for him that is comforting, but also challenging in some time and some places. And so, yeah, I think that I kind of had like a skeletal idea of the story. But in terms of the, you know, the ending action, I needed to work that out and figure that out.
Were there characters or plot points that surprised you?
That's a good question. I think, yeah, at the end, well, obviously don't want to give away the storyline,
right.
But something happens to the family at the end. And I think that I didn't initially intend for that. But I think the reason it comes about is that I couldn't have this story end neatly or happily, honestly. I think that just wouldn't fit the story very well. So I kind of needed to have this kind of, how should I call it? It's almost like an ugly ending in terms of, I didn't want it to be too sad, I guess, but I wanted something that was imperfect, I suppose, that would happen in to the family.
Now, it also kind of leaves an opening for another story.
Yeah, honestly, several people have said that, and it hadn't been my intention, but I can see that. I could definitely see how that could be interesting to pick up where it leaves off.
Yeah. Is that something that you think you might do?
I don't know. I think I am starting to think about it because enough people have mentioned it to me. But I had thought that for my next novel, I would want to just explore something more contemporary and closer to home. As they say, you should write what you know.
Yeah, so but you've got all this great source material. Which,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Is a lot of the source material, the family documents you have handwritten?
Some of it, like the childhood diaries, for example. Yeah. But no, I mean, a couple of the autobiographies they're typewriter written. And my grandpa is so funny. He's the one who he's like kind of the grammar nerd. And so my copy of one of the autobiographies has a lot of his markups in it, correcting family members.
Is he still living?
No, he passed away when I was 12, actually. Yeah.
So none of the brothers are?
No. No. Yeah, that would have been amazing to write this.
Yeah. So I just saw yesterday on social media that, I don't know if it's the Library of Congress or somebody, is looking for people who can still read cursive writing to transcribe old documents. And I'm like,
fortunately, this handwritten, my grandfather's handwriting from high school is pretty legible. So fortunately I didn't have to do a lot of deciphering there. Yeah.
Well,
I saw that post too. That's very interesting.
Did you? Yeah. And I thought, oh, that would be so fun. Now I do have also a lot of old family documents from the 1800s. And they are all handwritten. They're letters going back and forth, various family members. It's really fascinating to try and figure out what they're saying. And they make it, the handwriting is all very beautiful, but of course it's faded. And also, at times they didn't have much paper. So they'd like get to the bottom and then they'd start writing up the side, like in the margin, but partially going over what they'd written before. So it's, and one of the letters says, you know, hey, we're out of paper, so that's why I'm doing this.
Wow, that's incredible. But it sounds like you can read most of it.
I usually can, or by context can figure out, you know, figure out the rest. And I'm planning to do some transcriptions on those. In fact, I think I started it at one point a while back, but because it's so interesting. And like you said in your like these diaries, and that there's these little details that. So give me an example of like a detail from the autobiographies or the diaries that you used in the book.
Oh, a detail. Well, I guess one of the interesting things that didn't actually make it into the book is that my grandpa had a like a reading list for his high school class or something, and he just it was just a list of works that he had to read. And I looked them up, and every single one of them was out of print. And it's so
Wow.
interesting to think, like, the books that I was assigned in high school, they're still in print today. But what if, 100 years from now, some of them are out of print? And, it's been such a long time, I suppose, since my grandfather's upbringing. From the autobiography, the typed up autobiography, one detail that was interesting was the family would have what are called boxwallahs, who are basically like door-to-door salesmen who come with these big crates of things to sell. And they would stop by the houses, their house, and they would pull out trinkets or a lamp or something, and the sellers would tell them, yeah, it's from the US, it's American, it's very good quality. And my grandfather's family would say, well, we don't want American things. Like, we are American. We're in India. We want Indian things. And the sellers would like immediately change tact and would say, oh, that's made in India. So they were just so, like, they had such a humor about the way that things are done in India, I think. Like, there's such kind of like good-heartedness. Like, something like that, maybe an American, a modern day American would think, oh, they're scamming me or whatever. But I think at least the way that it's written in this autobiography, they had such a humorous, lighthearted look at the Indian people that they interacted with daily.
Now there's a scene where Arthur's at dinner and he's having to fan the people.
So those contraptions were called punkas, and that actually they had that at the house that they lived in real life. And it was a handheld or a hand operated fan.
So it was a
Those
ceiling
things cost
fan,
some.
but you turned a crank to keep it going. Interesting.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of kind of dangerous wildlife.
One of the details was actually my grandfather going into the latrine, and there's a panther in the latrine,
Oh my
and
goodness.
he just like slams the door and runs away. But yeah, that sort of thing really happened. Wildlife was pretty common. Wildlife encounters were pretty common.
And insects, deadly insects, ants. There seem to be ants
Oh
everywhere.
yes. Yeah, the way that they shook out their bedding before bed, that was a detail from the autobiographies as well.
Now there's a scene where they go to the old Gope. And what is that?
So the Gopwar is the ruins of a fort from the Mahabharata, which is a great historical war in India. And that actually did exist, and I visited it. And that the ruins were, I think they were more of like a temporary fort for a battle. They're pretty small, but it's near the Kangsabati River. It's on a hillside over the river. And I just, when we visited it, it was a really hot day, but it was a cool, peaceful, shady kind of oasis. And I was just kind of struck by. And I tried to capture it in the book, the way that Jean imagines, someone building this, centuries and centuries ago. And, it's just that feeling of being somewhere that is ancient and having this place that has existed for centuries. And what a joy that is, and what an interesting feeling that is to kind of be in such a place.
So. Now the boys go into the forest, and Arthur too, into the forest and the down to the river, and there's sort of you definitely convey this feeling of being in these wild places. How did you go into the forest yourself, or how were you able to do that?
Well, I like to think that that was drawn on my own appreciation for nature. I have always loved hiking, and especially here in California. You know, it's a very different climate than in India, but I feel, as a Californian, I'm pretty connected to nature. I go backpacking. I love landscape photography. So I like to think that I have a natural inclination for, you know, just appreciating nature and noticing the little details of that. So yeah, that was definitely something that I hope is a strong suit of the novel, and that it comes through my descriptions of nature, because very dear to me. Yeah.
Now, going back to your writing process, did you write it in the order that it's in the book, that in the finished form?
No, actually. And this was advice from the faculty writing program. Write the scenes that speak to you the most, I suppose, that you know, can picture so vividly and just could write it right away. And I think actually the first scene is not in the book. It's what I thought was going to be an opening scene of the boys racing around the house, which is very much in their personality. And there's a scene later of them at the big Bengal games, of, you know, them racing on the track. And so I thought I wanted to kind of open with a smaller version of that, of them running around the house. But it didn't make it in. I decided to take it out. After that, the first scene that I wrote that is in the book is the leopard encounter. So
which is quite a bit further into the book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the family goes on a hike in the jungle around their house, and they encounter a leopard. And that scene has changed somewhat, but that was the first one that I wrote. But yeah, in terms of my writing process, I kind of just wrote those like set piece kind of scenes where something really important happens, or something with high action happens, and just kind of connected the pieces that way. I thought that was just the easiest way for me to work it out, because then you have this kind of framework, but you still have room for things to change along the way if that should occur. And then actually, like, the whole storyline of Arthur was added completely secondary to, like, after I had already completed a whole first draft. I kind of built Arthur out more, because in the first draft I was very conscious of writing outside of my identity, and so I didn't feel confident enough to really write him fully. But then I realized, after completing a first draft, you know, he is a very important presence in this book, and he can't just be this, you know, half fleshed out character. He needs the full treatment that Gene gets, I think. So yeah, I did develop him, his storyline, further in the process.
So then what you kind of are going back and forth between Jean's point of view and Arthur's point of view, how did you like decide? I mean, the book's mostly chronological, I guess. So is that how, in terms of getting it in the right order?
You know, I wasn't too conscious of, you know, Jean's turn, then Arthur's turn, then Jean's turn, and making it equal like that. I really kind of thought to just follow like the rhythm of book, I suppose, if that makes sense. Like, just if something, you know, there are things that, of course, you know, Jean isn't present for, or Arthur isn't present for, so you know, it's very easy to decide whose point of view to use. But then the scenes where it is both of them, I would have to make the decision on, you know, whose perspective here will be more important to the story, I guess.
And did you ever write it one way and then say, no, I need to do it the other way?
So I actually didn't do too much rewriting in terms of perspective. I don't know that, but that is something that I have thought about as I have reread it, just thinking, you know, what if, you know, a certain scene had been a different perspective.
Interesting.
No, I didn't really rewrite it. Yeah.
Well, Joanne, I want to thank you for being with us today and sharing Sleeping in the Sun, which is your debut novel. And do you have any words of wisdom for someone starting out writing their first novel?
Oh, one of the sayings we would say in my MFA program was that writing a novel is like driving a car at night. Have you heard of this?
No.
It's where, so you can, you know, you can only see as far as the headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. So I thought that was really resonated with me in terms of, you know, this novel feels so daunting. And like I said, it took me 6 years, and you can only look so far ahead. But I think that just keep going and you will to the end someday. You will finish it. And,
and we never got into how you found your publisher. Do you have just a moment for that?
Oh, sure. So my publisher, She Writes Press, they are a hybrid publisher. I did try the traditional route. I submitted to lots of agents, and I got a fair amount of responses and interest. And ultimately, I think that people, you know, there's a money side to publishing, of course. And I think that it's a bit tough to sell Americans in India, I suppose. Like, it's not a really common topic. And I think it's tough to take a chance on something that seems to be somewhat new, especially for an author like myself, who is pretty unknown. So I turned to hybrid publishing, which was definitely something that was talked about in my MFA program, which is, it talked about hybrid publishing as this, you know, alternative to traditional publishing for authors, where you can get a bit more freedom. And these hybrid presses are more likely to take risks on books and authors that aren't well known. So I'm really grateful that I found them, and they have been wonderful to work with. I mean, just from like the cover design to just the suggestions that they've had. They had some minor editing comments about the book, and they suggested getting a sensitivity reader, which was excellent. And overall, just working with them was great and very professional. And I would recommend looking into them if you are interested in hybrid publishing.
Yeah, so, and the books that I've done, the authors I've done from them, are all very well done.
Great.
Yeah, I enjoy working with them too. So thank you for being with us today. We have time for our closing quote, which I found one from, I'm not going to pronounce her name correctly, but it's the actress from Black Panther, Lupita Nyong'o. And she said, "What colonialism does is cause an identity crisis about one's own culture." So I thought that was fitting for this book.
Yeah, I agree. That's very fitting.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye.